Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by Rory Carroll, who is the Irish correspondent, Ireland correspondent for The Guardian, and he is also the author of the brand new book, There Will Be Fire, Margaret Thatcher, the IRA, and 2 Minutes That Changed History. It is available everywhere, and it's just a fantastic read. It reads like a thriller. And Rory, as we jump into this, I love the fact that it teases us with 2 Minutes That Changed History, but you went back and told several years of history in this book. And those of us living in Iowa, we kind of knew about the IRA, kind of knew about Northern Ireland, remember car bombings in the 80s, at least I do from growing up. But when you sit back and look, what was the real genesis of the fight between Northern Ireland and England that led up to all the violence and bloodshed we saw in the last 30 years?
Gosh, well, I could start from 800 years ago during the Norman invasion of Ireland, and I think I need about 24 hours to actually answer that question. But the genesis was that when Ireland, the Irish nationalists, achieved de facto independence from Britain in 1921, the northern part of the island remained under the UK banner, because there were about 1 million Protestants who saw their identity as primarily British, and they did not want to be part of an Ireland dominated by Catholics. And so for the 20th century, that it remained so. But there was a Catholic minority that felt discriminated against, and they felt that they, you know, the Protestants were ruling as a sectarian statelet, and that the Catholics did not get proper housing or jobs. And that's then the civil rights movement, partly inspired by Martin Luther King's movement, which then led to violence and what we then came to call the Troubles.
I thought that was a very interesting term for it, the Troubles, and you even make mention of that in the narrative there. But the whole idea, when Margaret Thatcher first became Prime Minister, there was a very watershed moment at which she decided how she was going to deal with the terrorism, essentially, from Northern Ireland, treating it as a criminal act versus some type of act of war. How important was that in what was to transpire later?
Yeah, that was a fateful decision on her part that, in a sense, seeded the whole plot of what then transpired, because she decided to, yes, treat them very much as criminals, and that the police, rather than the army, would take the lead role in combating the IRA, and that the prisons, which until then had more or less had allowed the IRA to use the prisons as kind of prisoner of war compound. I mean, think kind of World War II style prisoners of war. The British decided, no, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to treat them like just regular criminals. And in so doing, delegitimize the entire armed struggle and this attempt of national liberation, as the IRA saw it. And this, for the IRA, was completely unacceptable. And so the IRA prisoners decided to go. They made lots of protests. And then finally they went on a hunger strike. And one by one, IRA and also INLA prisoners started to die under Thatcher's watch. In total, 10 died. The first of them was Bobby Sands, and he became, with the rest, these kind of iconic martyrs to the Irish Republican cause. And Thatcher, in so doing, became she became a demon. I mean, she entered the demonology of Irish nationalism. She was on a par with Oliver Cromwell and the kind of atrocities from the 17th century. And so the IRA decided, well, we need revenge. You know, we need to, our supporters are clamoring for this, but we need to go after her. Now, they had never tried anything on this scale before of any kind of such a high-level assassination against not just a prime minister, but the Iron Lady, you know, one of the 20th century's most kind of iconic politicians. And it took them about 4 years to get close to her. It was the plot really unfolded in the shadows as they really went to edge closer and closer to her.
The leading up to 1984 with the assassination attempt, the character in the book that really gets this whole thing started is Patrick McGee. And can you introduce us to him, please?
Yes. Patrick McGee was a West Belfast Catholic, like so many other IRA men. And he'd actually grown up for a time, spent a few years in England in his childhood. His family, his dad had gone there for work, which meant that he had an English accent for a time. And once he went, ended up back in Belfast and joined the IRA, firstly as a bomber, so he was a bomb maker, which was quite a risky thing to do because at that time a lot of IRA bombs blew up prematurely, killing their makers. But he was good enough and skilled enough that he didn't blow himself up. And he also had an English accent. So, or he could turn on an English accent if need be. So he was then chosen by the IRA, so-called England Department, that was responsible for exporting the Troubles from Northern Ireland over to England, where an IRA bomb in London, for example, would have much more impact in terms of media, in terms of just public sentiment, than 100 IRA bombs in Belfast. So McGee was sent over for the, you know, their most important, audacious operation in the IRA's history, which was this attempt to assassinate Thatcher and wipe out her entire government. And this so much depended on Patrick McGee. He was the last link in a very long chain of IRA surveillance operators, bomb makers, logistics people, who were all kind of operating in the shadows. But he, McGee, was the one who had to walk into that hotel, the Grand Hotel, on the seafront in Brighton, a town in southern England, and check in as a guest 3 weeks in advance of the Conservative Party conference and make it look like that he owned the place. You know, he had to look the part, like he was just a regular English guest there for a weekend. And he pulled it off. He booked himself into a room, a sea-facing room, and spent 3 days and three nights in there in September 1984, assembling the bomb, hiding it, and then checking out of the hotel and walking away and disappearing and making sure that nobody remembered him. And also he did his best when he did check in that he did not leave any fingerprints on the hotel registration card. And that proved to be, in the end, a very decisive mistake on his part, because it turned out, in fact, that he did leave a fingerprint on there. But he did manage to plant the bomb. And so to this day, I mean, his name is legendary in IRA circles.
I'm chatting with Rory Carroll about his brand new book, There Will Be Fire, Margaret Thatcher, the IRA, and 2 Minutes That Changed History. Rory, one of the creepiest things I remember from the book was thinking that this bomb was set up at the hotel in Brighton, the Grand Hotel, and it was set up for almost a month ahead of time with a timer. So you had people going in and out of this room, guests who were there not having any idea that there's a bomb set up there. And so when you were doing this research, how creepy was that for you as a journalist to try to think about what all could have transpired there?
Yeah, I mean, I went to the Grand Hotel and for my research purposes, and I checked into a room almost adjacent to the one that Patrick McGee had done. It's been completely rebuilt, of course, since it had been basically destroyed. But it was creepy. But, I mean, Patrick McGee, when I interviewed him, I mean, he said that, you know, the bomb, he armed the bomb and it started ticking or pulsing on his last night there. And he slept himself beside the bomb. I mean, it was, that's how confident he was that it wasn't going to go prematurely detonate. And so, you know, they had precision. I mean, the IRA had precision timers, which they obtained by cannibalizing VCR recorders. And that was the technology they used. And it was quite effective. And it was it was a precision bomb. And McGee was able to decide up to the exact minute and second, 3 weeks into the future, when the bomb would detonate. Now, where it was not precise, of course, was the fact that it was destroying a hotel filled with hundreds of people. A lot of them were government figures, and also there were the police guards, but also the hotel staffers. There was about almost 300 people in that hotel, and the idea was just kind of to destroy the whole hotel and try to entomb the Iron Lady there and as much of her government as possible.
I know that Patrick McGee wrote a book. It wasn't a mea culpa by any means, but you interviewed him, and that kind of got a lot of things started for you with this research. How important was he to your research for the book? Could you have done this without his willingness to talk to you?
Yes, because I had to, because he, in his own book, he's very upfront about saying that he was not going to reveal anything about any operational details about the Brighton plots, about the bomb. And in my interview with him, he did speak a little bit about a few things here and there, but mostly, you know, it still remains veiled, or in IRA lexicon, it remains tight. Because some of his comrades who are implicated in this have never been named or caught or charged, and in theory could yet be prosecuted for this. So, you know, I had to do a workaround and to kind of to retrace a lot of what he did. And I was quite lucky that enough time has passed that, you know, there are now IRA, former IRA members who are willing to talk about what happened, including the, I spoke to one called Michael Hayes, who was one of the commanders who sent McGee to London, to England for this operation. And he was very open about discussing these details because he felt that, you know, this was an important action in Irish and British history, and he wanted his own role to be recognized. So, you know, the timing is good in that sense. And also the, on the policing side, because half of the book is really, it's a true crime police procedural, because it's once the bomb goes off and we see the awful impact that it had, but then we're into the police investigation, you know, the and this extraordinary hunt that the multiple agencies of the British state undertook to identify and to catch the bomber. I mean, and this was in a kind of a pre-digital age in many ways, and yet it was a huge investigation spanning with Interpol, spanning more than 50 countries, and they're having to do this basically with hardly without any computers, and it was really, then it turned into a game of cat and mouse between the police and the IRA. So, I mean, the story just kind of spins off in these all these kind of crazy directions, and I had a lot of, I mean, it's fascinating speaking to the police because a lot of them are still alive, and they are very, most of them are now feel comfortable enough to discuss their own roles in this investigation because, you know, they also want it to go on the record about what really happened.
Is there a certain amount of hero worship of Patrick McGee by some on the fringes? And I liken it to the people that sort of have an affinity for John Hinckley, who attempted to assassinate President Reagan a few years before this incident.
Yes, there was and there is. I mean, when he was released in 1999 under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, I mean, he couldn't walk down the Falls Road without people in Belfast, which is a Catholic area, without people wanting to buy him a drink, because he was... He was not senior in the IRA, but he was, you know, the guy who almost killed Thatcher and who jolted the entire British government. So within that, you know, those Irish Republican circles, he was and remains something of a hero. But he's also a very enigmatic figure. He's very softly spoken. He's always a bit of a loner. And, you know, so he is... And he's stayed in many ways in the shadows even after his release. He's not become a political figure. He didn't join Sinn Féin to become a candidate or anything like that. So he kind of lives a more or less quiet life in Belfast.
It's a fascinating story, and the narrative you put together just reads like a thriller. The book is There Will Be Fire, Margaret Thatcher, the IRA, and 2 Minutes That Changed History by Rory Carroll. It's available everywhere. Rory, an amazing piece of journalism here you've done, and I thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.